when the Kinks first came to America, there was a big gulf in understanding. Even sense of humour was different. It still is to a degree, but it was drastically different then. But that, those barriers have been broken down through rock music. I think any sensible person who's at all creative has got an element of self-loathing in them. Yes, there's, with me they call it tongue-in-cheek. The secret is always make yourself get the brunt of it and not take it out on some other poor person. You know, because that's, I think that's the key to the best comedy as well. We can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Hi, this is Ray Davies of the Kinks in the studio for To The Bone, part two. And celluloid heroes never really die.
In part one of this interview, we showed you just how influential the Kinks have been to three decades of rock and roll. From heavy metal, just ask Ozzy Osbourne about the Kinks, to the original punk rockers in 1976, to 90s British band Oasis, they've all paid public homage to the music and attitude of the Kinks. And as we'll see today in the studio, you can add Madison Avenue to the long list of modern icons that the Kinks have influenced. In the double CD To The Bone, we now have the closest thing yet to a Kinks box set. The idea to re-record many of the Kinks' best songs live actually was germinated by executives at one of the Kinks' many previous record companies, Columbia Records and Sony Music. Here with the story is Ray Davies of the Kinks.
We did a bit of time at Columbia. I say giving it time, it's like doing a jail sentence. And one of the big things they wanted to do there, and to a certain extent they must have some of the credit for this record in that... But they ain't got it, but they got the credit. They wanted us to do a re-recording of all our tracks because they obviously were very interested in our catalogue. And I know that when we were talking to them and they were doing the so-called deal, the subject of the Kinks catalogue came up. But I explained the same as I've said to you, that the people involved will never give them up and never do deals with one another. And of course, being the company they are, Sony, Columbia, they said, money can do anything. But it can't, you know. There's only so much you can do with money. And I think they would have ideally liked us to record this album for them. But we only did it was only a one album deal and we parted company. So that was in my head, I guess, that this would be an interesting thing to do. But I didn't want to go in and re-record it because I felt it would be doing a disservice to the band because they're too good to do that. And so I thought this would be an ideal opportunity while they're playing tight and they're receptive and they've just been on a long tour, go in the studio and record with them and throw some of these songs at them for the first time. And there are a few mistakes on the record. I won't tell you exactly where.
So I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I can't sleep at night. Yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing. So I can't sleep at night. Yeah.
That song and another Kinks original, Tired of Waiting, are both in high-profile TV ads. Here's the writer of each, Ray Davis of the Kinks.
I don't watch a lot of television, but I haven't seen the ads yet. But everybody asks me about them, yeah. You see, I must point out at this stage, I don't have control over those two songs. So the judgment call is, as long as you're not doing harm to people and telling them to do something which is kind of completely wrong, And provided you're not bringing the copyright into disrepute, I suppose there's not much you can do about it. For many, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, there might be royalties in it, you never know. But I don't necessarily have control over that. And it's all down to taste, I think. So if it was a choice between having my song performed badly by a sort of cheesy cover, or having the original Kinks version, I'd go for the original version, because it's not saying that Van Halen is a cheesy cover. I mean, they can get other people exactly to duplicate it. So I'd rather they could use the original, because people will think it's us anyway. But the whole thing with It Really Got Me and the way we recorded it and subsequently the way Van Halen covered it in a more, I guess, aggressive form, was because it grabbed attention. And that's an attention grabber, that opening. And so you're dealing in a commercial world, and you've got the advertising sponsors saying, what can we get to grab attention? They'll get something like You Really Got Me every time, or Beethoven's Fifth or something. It's all to do with what sells. But divorcing, you know, but are we saying that You Really Got Me is going to make people buy cars? I'm not sure. It's just a device to draw people's attention, probably, to the television set. It's a very, very subjective thing. I am wary of the advertising world, but it's all this. The culture's so intermingled now. You know, what's art anymore? What is selling out? What's being commercial? You know, you've got ballet companies, you've got orchestras being sponsored by automobile foundations for endowment of the arts. It's also It's interacting so much now. But I wouldn't say that we've sold out. I think our music has been... It carries it on to a new audience. I know what's going to happen now. I'll do a date, or the Kinks will go on tour. We'll play somewhere like Utah, and people will be shouting out for the Nissan ad. or we'll play it, and they'll say, oh, you played that Van Halen song really well.
Well, baby, I feel good.
I say anthology because this album contains no less than 28 Kink songs spread out over 30 years. But a true anthology would consist of original studio releases. Over the three decades, several different and competing companies have gained ownership of the Kinks' recordings and Ray Davis' songs, making the usual box set anthology impossible. At best, a frustrating situation. I wondered how Ray Davis handled it.
After a while, you know, you get to live with it. You learn to live with it because I used to be very precious about my songs, you know. I remember recording a song called Waterloo Sunset, and I didn't even let the band hear the lyrics until it was mixed. And it gets a bit like a bit stupid, really, because it's meant to be heard by people. I find that now, in order to survive and not go completely mad, you just take it with a pinch of salt. And I've got a huge collection of demos I've done at home and lyrics and things that nobody will really ever hear. And so let's say that that's my own private collection. And the demos are always mine because nobody wants to put demos out. It don't matter much to me anymore. I mean, writing it's the most important thing. But the only thing that really irks me, I guess, is the fact that the tapes fall into the wrong hands occasionally. You know, modern things like bootlegging, and it's so easy to do copies now, and like really good copies. And I think that's the only thing that really pisses me, if you like, or makes me angry.
Okay, this is called Waterloo Sunset. Oh, one, two, three, four.
it didn't take long for the attitudes that the original punk rockers shared with the Kinks to be recognized by Ray Davis.
I remember when the Sex Pistols came out in England, they were unsigned, and I had a small label at that time. I tried to sign them to Conk Records. Well, yeah, because they were the funniest thing I'd ever seen. They were great. It's a wonderful comedy group. But, you know, see, that's the difference. I thought it was funny, but lots of people, might say my peers, were threatened by it. And particularly Mick Avery and I went to see a gig, and Mick thought it was the funniest thing he had ever seen. And he said, you've got to sign these guys to Conk because, yeah, we're looking. But, you know, there's that other thing in their music. It was it was vaudeville, in a sense. And it's a tradition of that I always rejected for a long time, the idea that vaudeville could carry on through music and into bands like the Kinks and the Beatles particularly. But you look at the end of the Beatles video, Free as a Bird, I think they actually cut into a vaudeville theatre with a ukulele player. And there is that element in British music still. It's the small vaudeville mentality, which is like a small 500-seater. You know, they were theatres that people used to go to, I guess, the turn of the century, and they died out in the mid-50s. But the Sex Pistols were pure vaudeville. The tragedy that followed was Sid's death. But, you know, Sid, I suppose he had to die. I mean, there was no other thing for him. It's all part of the plot. The saddest thing about the Sex Pistols was Malcolm McLaren, really. I mean, the fact that his cynical management, I suppose, worked in many ways, because without him, they couldn't have been manipulated into the force they were. The sad thing was that they broke up. I mean, I'd like to see. But what's even sadder is that they came back. Because I like John. I think he's good. I think he's very clever. I wanted to see how they were, but I just thought it was too sad. Sad by comparison with the original. I know it's easy for me to say that. There are people who say, well, we saw the Kinks last year and they were good, but it wasn't like the first time I saw them. I suppose there's all that element to take into consideration. But when you think that John wanted to kill everybody, I mean, when it came out, and there he was. I remember meeting John in a bar in Philadelphia about 6 years ago, and I said, John, what are you doing? He said, Ray, I'm doing everything I ever hated. I said, what's that? He said, I'm opening for INXS. I suppose, you know, but at least he knows what he is, and they still make me laugh, and I still get an immense amount of pleasure with their music. I suppose we all have to get old and fat, but not that fat.
standing on an island in the middle of the road. Traffic either side of me, which way would I go? I should have stayed at home, I should have never come outside. Now I wish I never tried to cross the other side. I'm in a state of confusion.
Originally released in 1983, that's The Kinks with State of Confusion, recorded live for the album To the Bone. Next, Ray Davis recalls how one of The Kinks' biggest hits could nevertheless be banned from the radio. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with The Best of The Kinks, Part 2.
Hi, this is Ray Davis of The Kinks, in the studio for To the Bone, Part 2. And not until I'd written X-Ray, my book. It wasn't until I finished that I realised the people that influenced me, my real career was based on an area like less than a mile square, Muswell Hill, Highgate, where I grew up, two villages in London, and all the characters I saw there. So I learned a lot there, and I learned that people are interesting because of their faults. The perfect characters didn't interest me at all. It was the people who had a bit of edge to them, kind of hid away in cafes behind the shadows so nobody noticed them. They were the people that I was drawn to. And I suppose that carried on in my writing and songwriting and lyric writing. I think that when the Kinks first came to America, there was a big gulf in understanding. Even sense of humour was different. It still is to a degree, but it was drastically different then. But those barriers have been broken down through rock music, through pop songs, through people coming over with ideas. I remember when we first recorded Lola, it was banned in Australia and a few other countries because it dealt with, I don't know, someone who's a transvestite, a transsexual. But now it's commonplace. I mean, transsexuals are accepted as part of society. That's how the world evolves. And I think that the latter part of this century has been, a slightly better place, I think, because of rock music. I think it's really broadened people and made people sort of more, or less judgmental on others and actually try to understand other cultures rather than turning it into a violent, drug-crazed world. I don't think rock and roll's contributed that much. I think that the drug culture was emerging in the 50s and the 40s. It was there in the 30s, but they called it something else. The only thing that's happened is, I think, the ordinary people have become, part of that culture. Whereas, you've got all the stories in Hollywood in the 30s were people like doing lots of cocaine and doing drugs to stay sharp and stay on the set and look great. I wouldn't blame the culture on rock and roll. I think rock has improved the culture. Even some of the stuff that's possibly banned on radio. You know, I think we've got a really discerning, for the most part, audience out there. I mean, people can make their own minds up about records. I'm not saying that people should have the right to put out sheer abuse on the radio and just for the sake of it, just to grab attention. You know, the audience will know. They'll turn off eventually.
In the club down in old Soho, where you drink champagne, it tastes just like a cherry cola. C-O-L-A. Yeah. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance.
I asked her her name in another brown voice. She said, Lola, L-O-L-A. La 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 la. Well, I'm not the world's most physical guy, but when she squeezed me tight, she nearly broke my spine. Oh, my Lola, la 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 la. I'm not dumb, but I can't understand why she walked like a woman but talked like a man. Oh my Lola, la 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 la, la 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 la. Well, we drank champagne and danced all night under electric candlelight. Lit me up and set me on a beat. Said, dear boy, won't you come on with me?
Fitted in with any, I guess we, yes, we're British, part of the British invasion and all that, but we never really fitted in with most of those groups of people. I don't know, we just didn't get along. You know, yes, I like Mick Jagger, he's a nice bloke, and Keith is a wonderful laugh, a great guitarist, and I don't know, I just didn't feel part of it. I was doing it for another reason, and I was just doing, I just came into the band so I could, because I'd walked out of art college, and I wanted to make money quickly, so I could go and study art in another country, because I felt that England wasn't the place for me to be. I wanted to go and study art in Italy, or the latest thing, or the last thing I tried to do was go get into Polish film school, which was the hip thing to do then. And I thought, you really got me if that was a hit. It would pay for my schooling. Unfortunately, I had to do follow-ups, but then it turned into something else. I found my own art through that. So I was doing it, everyone does it for different reasons, but the Kinks never fitted in with it. And particularly, I think it's my fault, because I became the front man of the band, and I was the most secretive person imaginable. I didn't want anybody even to take my picture. And of course, when you're a front man, you have to be splashed everywhere. You know, you have to be more of a whore than the others, if that's possible. And I rejected all that. So we turned into the great invisible band that nobody really knew what we looked like. Then everyone knows the name, but they don't really put the faces to it. What do you do for a living? It's the whole thing. You know, it's you meet somebody on an airplane. But for the most part, the people you wouldn't expect, like the guys who work for the Bank of England, you know, are Kinks fans. And for the most part, people don't know who I am. And that's, I kind of like that. Because I can still write, you know. Like R.D. in my book, he still wrote in secrecy and privacy, even though the world had forgotten him. Yeah, it's like, it's that sort of thing. I couldn't cope with this high-profile stuff, like poor old Mick Jagger and Jerry Hall, you know, just have to have a quarrel and they're on the front page, in England anyway. I just couldn't cope with that, go mad. Now, in the dark bars and cafes, that's my zone.
I put a parking lot on a piece of land where the supermarket used to stand. Before that they put up a bowling alley on the side that used to be the local parade. That's where the big band used to come and play. My sister went there on a Saturday, come dancing. All our boyfriends used to come and call. Why not come dancing? It's only natural. Saturday, another day. She would be ready, but she'd always make a way. In the hallway, in anticipation, he did another normal in that big frustration. He'd end up blowing on his wages for the week, or for a cuddle and a peck on the cheek. Come dancing, that's how they did it when I was just a kid. But when they said come dancing, my sister always did. Of my window, I could see them in the moonlight. Two silhouettes kissing by the garden gate. The day they knocked on the palace, my sister stood and cried. The day they knocked on the palace, part of my childhood died just then. My sister's married and she lives on an estate. Her daughters go out, now wish they turn away. She knows they get away with things as if they could. But if I asked her, I wonder if she would come dancing. Come on, sister, have yourself a ball. Don't be afraid to come dancing. It's only natural. Saturday night, my sister used to go to the party, and she used to come home and say, hey Ray, I came dancing tonight.
Yeah, it's interesting, Come Dancing came late, or relatively late, as a single. You know, it's one of our biggest American selling records as a single, and yet it's the most alien subject matter for American audiences. A Cockney spiv small time hood singing about a dance hall he used to go to in East London. I mean, it's so sort of localized, the humor in it. But then it was a huge hit here. I think going back to the Kinks, all we wanted to do, because I come from this family, as I say in my book and my show, that sisters who used to go out dancing and bring boyfriends home, much older than the boys, Dave and myself, and listening to their records. And all we wanted to do is make music for our sisters to dance to, I guess, or, you know, not the end of the Kinks' career, but so late in the Kinks' career, we do a song called Come Dancing, which really started it all. It's going to be a stage show, a musical. You know, you can never guarantee with musicals, because they're on one minute, they're off the next. But I think this will have a home. We're doing it in a theatre in East London next September. Not the Kinks, but the show's being put on. It'll be nice to see it on stage, because the work we've done on it so far is really, I think it's really spot on. It's a period piece, obviously. It's set in the late 50s, but it's about people, so I think it will travel quite well. Be interesting to see if it gets put on in America. Hi, this is Ray Davis of the Kinks in the studio for To The Bone, Part 2. I think any sensible person who's at all creative has got an element of self-loathing in them. Yes, there's with me they call it tongue-in-cheek. The secret is always make yourself get the brunt of it and not take it out on some other poor person. You know, because I think that's the key to the best comedy as well. It's easy to take the piss out of people, you know, and it's easy to ridicule people. But, you know, to turn it in on yourself at the end of the day is important. And certainly in my stage performance, I always do that in the sense that, I guess, what is humour? I mean, you're just making yourself up, you know, just make yourself laugh at the world, and hopefully it'll make you feel like a better person. I think maybe that's what humour is. But to do it at somebody else's expense is not great, and it's just a cheap shot.
When you're getting on, sat by the fireside, pondering on. Picture book, pictures of your mama, taken by your papa a long time ago. Picture book of people with each other to prove they loved each other. A picture of you in your birthday suit, sat in the sun on a hot afternoon. A picture book, your mama and your papa, and fat old Uncle Charlie out boozing with their friends. Picture book, a holiday in August, outside a bed and breakfast at sunny Southend. Picture book of people with each other to prove they loved each other.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Ray Davis of the Kinks with Red Beard.
Thank you, Ray. In the 1980s, various members of the Beatles, Rolling Stones, The Who, and Led Zeppelin were all reluctant to discuss their past for fear that it would preclude any artistic future. But one by one, these musicians have acknowledged their musical milestones and embraced their past. Ray Davis of the Kinks can relate.
Listen, I can understand it because it's put yourself in their shoes, poor old boys. You know, they got stuff they want to write, I suppose. I could understand them not wanting to be sort of trapped by their past because it's like saying to Picasso, you know, you can't paint any more pictures after the blue period. And he was 40 years old when he was going through that, or cubism, whatever. And unfortunately, it's not even the fans that say that. It's all the things you have to go through. I'm talking about media people, record companies, TV, radio. They're the people that sort of are judgmental on this. I think fans always have this theory. The great thing about playing live, it's the one occasion you can be one-on-one with your fans without going through all the business of relying on somebody to cut the record, someone to press the record, to do the artwork, then to play the record. You know, it's the key holders, whatever they are. And I can understand, but I can go back to your question, I can understand that the guy's being a little bit reticent about talking about the past too much. But, you know, I've never really had a problem with that because even when I was 21, I was writing songs for my granddad to sing. They wrote songs, and the classic one is Pete, who wrote "Wish I Could Die Before I Get Old." He's not that old now. He's middle-aged now. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's a damning line to have written. If the work's good, be remembered for good work. And hopefully the new work you do will be better or as good, or maybe not as good. But at least if you can function and write and perform, I think it's quite a blessing to be able to do that. So, but you've got to understand these guys have tremendous egos. You know, I've no idea what it's like to have an ego, but they must have continual worries. You know, but coming, you know, when Robert Plant was 20, he had his first hit, and it was a sexually driven song. Led Zeppelin music was, you know, it was a head job. You know, it's a bit more difficult to carry that off. Whereas I've had character songs, you know, Celluloid Heroes. I could be 90 years old when I'm singing that, and I wouldn't have to worry whether I'd be embarrassed by singing it, because I think it's kind of ageless.
Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in movies. It doesn't matter who you are. There are stars in every city, in every house and on every street. And if you walk down Hollywood Boulevard, their names are written in concrete. Don't tread on Greta Garbo as you walk down the boulevard. She looks so weak and fragile, that's why she tried to be so hard. But they turned her into a princess, and they sat her on a throne. But she turned her back on stardom, because she wanted to be alone. You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you have even heard of. People who worked, suffered and struggled for fame. Some who succeeded, some who suffered in vain. Valentino looks very much alive, and he looks up ladies' dresses as they sadly pass him by. Avoid stepping on Bela Lugosi, because he's liable to turn and bite.
but stand close by Betty Davis, because hers was such a lonely life. Well, you can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you hardly even heard of. People who worked, suffered and struggled for fame. Some who succeeded, some who suffered in vain. Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in showbiz. It doesn't matter who you are. But those who are successful, be always on your guard. Success walks hand in hand with failure along the Hollywood Boulevard. Stars as you walk down Hollywood Boulevard. Some that you recognize, some that you hardly even heard of. People who worked, suffered and struggled for fame. Some who succeeded, some who suffered in vain. La 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 la. A non-stop Hollywood movie show, a fantasy world of celluloid villains and heroes. Because celluloid heroes never feel any pain, and celluloid heroes never really die.
Just finished first draft from the next book, and a lot of it is inspired by that time I was living in. I was staying a lot in California, just off Hollywood Boulevard. I got into meeting a lot of different characters, and I went back there recently, and basically the same characters are there. They're the aspiring people that come to this place. It's got this magical quality to it, to get destroyed by it. I mean, it's a very destructive place. And yet, as destroyed as they get, if there's an opportunity to be an extra in a film, they'll grab the opportunity. Then it's not a coincidence that you've got a lot of religious cults around a place like Hollywood. You know, just around the back of Hollywood Boulevard now is a big Scientology hotel. There's a lot of religious cults around there. All you've got now on Hollywood Boulevard is prostitution, drugs, a few sleazy eateries, but wonderful. They've always been sleazy, and that's the magic of it. There's not really big money there. Most people go there because they expect all the glamour, but it's the sleaziest place, the most wonderful place to go, because the day is all you've got, because you're dead after the day, and tomorrow's another slog. And you realize that more than anywhere else in this place, Hollywood, because it's so destructive and so seductive still to me. I was back there in the summer because I was finishing up this story I was writing about it, and it hadn't changed since I wrote that song, 15, 20 years ago, maybe more, and it hasn't changed since then. You've still got the same characters there. It was just a wonderful time, and the song... You know, when you do research on a song and work it out properly, it really writes itself. The funniest thing about the record is that the original record is that we had to deliver an album in New York on the Monday, and we hadn't recorded this song and Celluloid Heroes and two other tracks for the album. So we went in Friday morning and recorded all through the weekend without a break. And the last track we did was Celluloid Heroes. And I was doing the vocals and mixing it at 9 o'clock in the morning on the Monday morning. And I was going to go straight to the airport to get on the plane to take it to the States. And the sound engineer had to sort of sleep. He was asleep, but I made him sleep by the door so the next session couldn't get in. And I had to do the mix myself because the second engineer had gone home. And the main engineer, a guy called Mike Boback, I remember his name, Mike had to sleep by the door to keep the next session out. So we'd be thrown out. And it's when you hear that nice, gentle ending, you know, it dies away into sort of mystic, like someone's beating the door, shouting for us to get out of there. Welcome back in the studio. I'm Ray Davies of the Kinks with Red Beard. Well, in my show, it alludes to me more as a performer, and it's after a long tour, you come back home, and in the end, all the wonderful life you have on the road, whatever, you got to go home sometime. And you walk into the house, and you walk in and realise that somebody's left, and the one you loved has gone. Maybe it's you deserve it, maybe you don't, but sometimes it's the things they leave behind and cast out that that really hurts. You know, they take all the valuables, they take all the best furniture, whatever. But they leave the things behind that maybe reminded them of you. And in this case, it was an album, the vinyl album. And they don't want it anymore because they were the songs you sang when you were in love. But and you always find that when they do things like this, they like to stick the knife in harder and they leave the gramophone behind, the record player, so you can play the record all night and just think of the good times. And every time you hear a track with a memory, whatever, it sort of digs in really deep. And that's when these things cut, I guess, to the bone. That's how these things evolve. And that's how I set this song up. And when you hear the lyrics, I think you'll understand why.
In the back of a record rack, there's an old double pack, 12 inches and black, with an old crumpled cover, but every track is stacked. And it takes me back to the one who caused this melancholy mood, and every single groove cuts me to the bone. Just made for you. Then we danced the song of passion. The singers fell the tones on the gramophone while the record played. She rocks me to the bone, knocks me to the bone. Those rocking old romantic songs laid all summer long. Thank you.
covered up the screams when lovers' harmony went oh so wrong. And in every word emotion is torn, and blood flows down the drain like she opened up a vein and cut me to the bone. Just like a nail as she rocks me to the bone, knocks me to the bone. She rocks me to the bone.
Is Redbeard in the studio thanking Ray Davis of the Kinks for cutting it to the bone. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, at Upper Room Recording, Cedar Vale, Texas. Associate producer and engineer Doug Hall. Transcription by Jane Carpenter. In the Studio theme by Andy Timmons. Check it out at www.andytimmons.com.